We're turning our attention to Wisconsin's weather and climate now here on the Ideas Net. Steve Ackerman, professor and director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies at UW-Madison, one of our guests. He was recently honored, got the NASA Exceptional Service Award. Maybe we can talk. Well, John will probably talk about that. Steve is always he's so modest, but we'll have John talk about that. John Martin is chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. Guys, welcome back.
It's great to be back.
Good to be here.
John, what's this award that Steve got?
Steve got the NASA Exceptional, what's it called again?
Public Service Medal or something.
It's
like
the
that.
Highest award NASA gives to civilians. Isn't that correct?
It's one of those that are up there, yeah.
So it's for continued excellence at running, you know, SIMS, his program that he heads. And they're just a phenomenally productive group. People in the state should know more about this than they do, and it's partly our fault. Although SIMS does a really good job of public relations. But it's we were talking about it on the way over. We've got an active search on for a faculty member in our department, and we already have an aggregate level of expertise, one sliver of SIMS, that deals with tropical cyclones that's unrivaled anywhere in the country. Oh. And so some of the best information and research and new learning about tropical cyclones occurs in central Wisconsin. And, you know, this is one of the things about this university that's outstanding. And if you've got a guy like Steve who's running that kind of a group, and as I said, it's a sliver of what they do.
Yeah.
But every single one of those slivers is high profile nationally. So he absolutely deserves that award. He's a fantastically talented colleague.
I would agree. And SIMS, by the way, stands for?
Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies.
SIMS.
And I got a real medal, but I don't have anywhere to wear it, although a friend of mine suggested I wear it at faculty meetings.
Oh, absolutely.
that it might just increase my voice a little
bit. I think it would. I think it would. You know, you get rid of the Long Island accent and you wear a medal. I think you're really talking about success.
I go a long way.
The sky's the limit.
Oh, well, let me give the phone number, by the way. If you'd like to join in and have a question about the weather or climate, you can reach us by calling 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234, or email us at talk@wpr.org. You know, that low pressure system that we had, that really windy weather about a month ago, it also broke the record for the lowest pressure when the barometer hit 28.38.
Yeah, 955.2, somewhere outside of Duluth. Although now I will say that, and I cannot quote for you all of the numerical support for this, this is not the all-time lowest sea level pressure of a non-tropical storm in the continental United States. That's not quite accurate.
It's not. Oh,
someplace else got down about another millibar lower, and I cannot recall where it was. However, I will say in a follow-up to that, that this was easily the most remarkable event in the storied history of the northern Great Plains states of the United States. There's no question about that.
Well, it was similar to a general or a central pressure reading inside a Category 2 hurricane.
Category 3 even.
Category 3?
Yeah. Category 3 even. Yeah, it was an amazingly intense cyclone.
So these kinds of storms don't come along.
No.
I'm sure John wanted to say not often enough.
No, not often enough. The last rival that this thing had was in 1998, and the last rival before that was in 1978. So they're about once every 20 years or so.
Yeah.
Something on that order.
And we had wind gusts 76 miles an hour in Chilton.
Yeah.
An F1 tornado in Racine County. And that was the 44th tornado of the year.
And we weren't even done then. We had some in early November.
Yeah, that's right. We had one just recently.
It was in November
16th
or something?
Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah,
Southeast, so, Wisconsin. And the record for tornadoes in Wisconsin is
60-something.
62. I think 62. It's 62.
In 2006 or 7?
Yeah,
not
one
too
of those
long
years.
Ago. Yeah,
one of those years.
Ago.
Well, I know that it was forecast that somebody, I forget who it was now, forecast that this year for Wisconsin was going to be this past year was going to be a big year for tornadoes. Mm-hmm. Nothing like Minnesota.
No, yeah. Minnesota is like the new Oklahoma.
Is that right?
They had 104, and they had 48 twisters in one day in June.
Wow.
And that their previous record was like 70-something, right? 74. So they,
wow.
Yeah.
So they got, they got more than half their annual record in one day.
Right.
Wow.
Isn't that incredible?
That's amazing.
Yeah.
It's not a state you think of with, and some of them were F3s, F4s too.
Yeah, amazing.
Pretty strong.
I was in northern Wisconsin, Bayfield County, last week, and we had a little snow there. Mm. Not a lot, but we had 4 or 5 inches, I think, something like that. And November 5th of 1991, we had a storm hit Superior, 31 inches of snow.
Boy. Unbelievable.
31 inches.
That was less than a week after the Halloween storm in Duluth, which was a something similar, 40-something inches of snow, October 31st, 91.
That, so back-to-back like that?
Almost. Boy, that's, I wonder what the story was on that. I don't know. I'm not familiar with that.
Well, that the 31 inches was a state record for a single snowstorm.
Wow. Wow.
Almost 3 feet. That'd be tough to keep up with snow plowing.
That is a superior amount of snow.
Yeah, it's superior.
Well, are we expecting anything like that the next...
John's hoping, I'm betting.
Yeah, but, I am hoping. I was talking to two of our undergrads. I got off the bus and I met him walking in and I said, so how's your vacation and all that? And about 2 minutes into our conversation, it turned to snow, whether or not we were going to get any. And I'm kind of frustrated that we haven't had any yet. Seattle had a big snow on the... over the Thanksgiving holiday, and that doesn't usually happen before we get ours.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm a little upset.
I don't think we'll get one that big down here, though. That's
I don't see anything on the horizon. You know, flurries maybe, but nothing serious, at least for the next few days.
Why is it, people have asked this, Minneapolis, St. Paul area gets more snow per year than any part of Wisconsin typically?
I would bet that's not, you can't back that up. I would bet the snow belt.
I'd guess you have to exclude the snow belt.
Yeah, you got to get rid of Ironwood to Superior, and then after that, maybe Minneapolis gets a little bit more than us. It probably has to do with the exact, the path of the storms that occur during the cold season. They have a preferred path over a broad scale. There's a preference to go right across our region. But if they go to our southeast, to Chicagoland area, then we get heavy snow. If they go to La Crosse or between Madison and La Crosse, Minneapolis gets heavy snow. I suspect over the course of centuries, there's a bit of a bias towards storms that are somewhere between Madison and La Crosse, and that gives Minneapolis a better chance of getting heavy snow. However, the winter of 2007-2008, which we had our first, that 100-inch snow, Minneapolis was snow-starved. So it's not always true. We had 90 plus in mid-February, and they had 29 by that time.
Holy mackerel.
So it's not always the case, but it has a lot to do with storm track.
Yeah. I had some great pictures from that winter.
What a great winter that was.
I spent it in D.C. What a great winter that was.
No, you missed it. Too bad.
Oh, I get some great pictures of my daughter standing outside of these mounds of snow that are like 8 feet high.
Oh, that was amazing.
Oh, man. Well, let's give our callers a chance. If you'd like to join in, the number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Let's go to Jane in Cedarburg. Jane, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Well, I came in from raking leaves just to ask this question. Very often, the record setting for a day, no matter whether it's rain or cold, is in the 1800s. Now, did they have a different way of measuring their weather than we have now? And why do they have so many records in the 1800s? Hmm.
There were a few really cold years in the 1880s, so they show up every once in a while as record cold days. I don't know so much about the precipitation records. I can't say at the front end, the measurement devices have improved, but they're not in a category difference from what we had in the late 19th century. So I think those measurements are probably comparable in skill to what we have today for the basic variables like precipitation amount and high and low temperature. But I'd also say that if you carefully scrutinize the entire calendar, you're going to find that the record highs and lows are distributed fairly evenly over the last 150 or so years. There may be periods where the 1800s seem to have some a dominance, but I wouldn't say, certainly it's not true that they dominate throughout the year.
Actually, we're just updating our intro meteorology book. If you look at the maximum temperatures and the minimum temperatures, the records, the all-time records for the states, The record decade is the 1930s.
Yeah, 1930s.
They have
I was
a
say that.
Lot of records set in the 1930s for both minimums and maximums.
Yeah, South Dakota's all-time low and all-time high were set in 1936.
Right, yeah. There was a lot of that going on. So something was, and that was, of course, the drought years, too.
Yeah.
So, you know, I guess not having clouds around, you would expect that you would get your maximum daytime temperatures and your minimum nighttime temperatures. Yeah. So maybe it is consistent.
So it's the Dust Bowl era there.
Yeah, right. Yep.
Yeah, if somebody had asked me, if the caller had asked me, what would you guess was the decade, I would have said
the 30s. You would have picked that decade? You would have been right.
Yeah. But I would have been thinking about just the Dakotas, so I would have been based on the wrong thing.
But that's temperature, you know, and the callers, I remember pictures, too, that of snowfalls, record snowfalls, that a lot of times seem to be in the late 1800s. Mm. So
well,
maybe
thank
it is.
You.
All right. Thanks very much.
Now back to racking the leaves. We could talk longer if you don't want to rake your leaves.
Bill in Winneconne, it's your turn. Hi, Bill.
Hi. How are you? Great program. What my question is, places like Wisconsin have 80-mile-an-hour winds, or Montana 10 days a year has winds between 90 and 110 or so. And yet when New York gets 40 miles an hour at 3 inches of snow, there's some goofy weatherman standing out there in his arca claiming what an event this is.
Mm-hmm.
Can you explain that?
Stupidity? We're both from the East Coast.
Yeah.
So.
Follow the money. Right. That's my guess. I think it's population density at play there. I hear that a lot from some of our graduate students from Minnesota who have spent their lives, you know, sort of routinely shoveling 12-inch snowfalls. And when 6 inches of snow falls in Washington, D.C. or New York City corridor, you know, that's big news, it's national news, and they get a little frustrated. I can certainly understand why they're frustrated, but I think it's just population density.
Yeah, I mean, most of the population is on the coast. But you're right, we just survive those winds without complaining.
Right, that's right. Right.
We don't need to get out into them.
But why is it also that Washington and New York freeze up solid when there's 3-4 inches of snow? I mean, it's been snowing there for at least 100 years. You think they'd figure it out?
I think they do have it figured out. I'll bet you that, especially New York City and Boston and places like that, and Hartford, Connecticut, they've got it better figured out than the media lets on. Washington is different. I don't think they have sufficient snow removal, and they are hedging their bets all the time against climatology. They don't usually get a lot of snow. Last winter, they got hammered. The Baltimore-Washington area got hammered. And it was really bad news because they have no remedy for that. But New York City all the way up to Portland, Maine, they have remedy for it in varying degrees, and they usually know how to handle it.
Huh.
Just a lot of hot air in Washington.
Just a lot of hot air in Washington. That keeps it warm. Well, I tell you what, Karen in Eau Claire wonders if there's a website where you can look up the types of Wisconsin records we're talking about. She's interested in Eau Claire, for example.
Yeah, the state climatology site probably has it, and that's...
I never remember the website.
I think it's sco.wisc.edu.
That could be right.
What is it again?
I think it's sco.wisc.edu for a state climatology office.
Oh, sco.wisc.edu.
Yeah.
Or if you just search on Wisconsin State Climatology Office, I suspect that'll pop up.
That'll come right. That's how I get there.
Yeah.
And they'll have that.
All right. Well, I'll tell you what. We'll continue our conversation on weather and climate with our guests Steve Ackerman and John Martin right after we take a look at the news here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Happy to have you with us here on the Ideas Net. Larry Mueller here talking Wisconsin's weather and climate with Steve Ackerman, professor and director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies, and John Martin, professor and chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. Join us with your questions at 1-800-642-1234. Email talk@wpr.org. And you know what? Richard is online from Nina with some stats for us. Hi, Richard.
Hi. There was a question earlier about snowfall in the Twin Cities compared to Wisconsin.
Yeah.
A couple of my daughters live in the Twin Cities, so this question often comes up. So I've looked it up, and I just looked it up on the NOAA website to confirm. And it turns out that St. Paul gets just a little bit more than any of the cities in Wisconsin. St. Paul comes in at 49.9 inches. Mm. And looking at Madison, Milwaukee, Green Bay, and La Crosse, they're all between 43 and 48.
Yeah, okay. So it's about the same.
So we lose the competition.
Yeah, but barely.
Yeah. But barely. Thanks, Richard.
Yeah, that's great.
You're welcome.
I appreciate the call. All right, looked it up. And here's Tiffany in River Falls with a question. Hi, Tiffany.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Thanks for calling.
Great. Thank you. I have a question about meteor showers. In the last, I would say, you know, like 6 months to 9 months, I have seen just an incredible amount of meteor showers. And I'm wondering if that has anything to do with climate change.
The meteors themselves wouldn't, right? Because the meteors, we see the meteors because the Earth's rotating around the sun, and then at certain times of the year, in particular, it passes through asteroid regions where you can pick up more meteors, or they can capture into the atmosphere, and then they come in and burn up, and we can see them. And particularly this time of year is a good time of year to pick some
right.
of those up. There was just a peak a week or 2 weeks ago, I think it was.
Yeah, about 2 weeks.
Yeah. So the only thing that would affect it climate-wise is having more cloud-free days.
Okay.
And I know this. We've been pretty dry these last couple of months.
The whole fall's been dry.
Been dry. So that would certainly make it more likely to be able to see them this past fall. I'm not sure about the last 10 years, but...
Yeah.
Okay. I was just wondering, because I saw one again this morning over here in western Wisconsin, and so I just thought it odd that I've seen so many.
Yeah, well, right now you're going to be, you'll still see it. You know, we've gone through that belt. But.
Yeah. We just went out, my wife and I think it was a week ago or 2 weeks ago. I can't remember now. It was on a Wednesday, that I remember, and it was a cold night. We went out and saw a couple and then went back inside. It was too cold.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks very much for calling. I can remember being in northern Wisconsin 1 year in November, middle of November at night. And I mean, there was never a point for a long period of time, you know, a half an hour at least. And then I got cold and went inside.
Yeah.
There was always one in the air.
They're amazing to watch. But I remember standing out there with Ann watching them getting cold and wondering, why can't this happen in July?
Yeah, well, no. But if it did happen in July, because there's another shower that comes in late July, early August, you're getting attacked by mosquitoes.
The
best time is like mid-October when it gets down to 45 at night, maybe.
Right, so not so...
handle that.
Right,
you know?
All right, there we've got it. Let's go to Niles in Ontario, Wisconsin. Hi, Niles.
Hey, well, let's go from mosquitoes back to snow.
All okay.
Right. Oh, you got it.
All right. I'm born and raised in Superior, and when I graduated college, I moved up to UP in Michigan, up by Houghton Hancock area.
Oh, man.
And, yeah, I hear you. it wasn't as cold, though. But why is it that Houghton Hancock can get, like, 400 inches a year, and Superior, being like, what, 130 miles, 150 miles away, gets an average of, what, 90?
Yeah, maybe even closer to 100. I guess I don't know exactly, but I think one of the things is the Kenai Peninsula is a factor.
Yeah.
And then the fetch over Lake Superior is so much longer when you're off on the Upper Peninsula than when you're tucked away almost into Luth.
Okay,
that's
sure.
a big factor. You need easterly winds to really get a lot of lake effect snow in Superior, or straight northerly winds. You can get any variant from north to northwest in Houghton, Hancock to get hammered with snow, and you've got elevation too. The Iron Mountains are there. That helps too.
So yeah, it's yeah.
Perfect
well,
setup.
Why is it also that the snow is drier? I lived in Ontonagon, Michigan for 12 years, and you couldn't ever make a snowman. We lived a mile in from the lake, but it was dry snow, powder.
Yeah. This is a common thing, too. I think places like Buffalo and West Cleveland, I think places that really get a lot of lake effect snow, I think it's probably because the time where you accumulate most of your snow is when you have severe cold air outbreaks. So you're really you're nucleating the snow, creating the ice crystals at extremely low temperatures, and they just, they won't stick together at all. So there's a lot of airspace between them when they're formed at such cold temperatures, and when they accumulate on the ground at cold temperatures as well.
All right.
That's probably it.
All right. Thank you very much for calling. So it's kind of fluffier.
Yeah, it's very fluffy. You know, when we get snow around in Madison, when the temperature's in the low single digits, it's the same kind of thing. You slam your foot down and you get this huge, almost snowshoe-sized footprint, you know, because you can push that snow around so easily.
Right.
A lot easier to shovel.
Yeah, it is.
A lot easier.
Unless it's windy. Then it's always blowing in your face. And stuff.
Yeah, and the mistake is they often use these rollers, you know, like they did in the famous Patriots-Dolphins game.
But that creates ice.
Yeah.
So you end up really ruining the walkways with them. You got to get out there and shovel it.
Right, yeah.
Stop using those things.
Dick in Waukesha, we turn to you. Hi, Dick.
Yeah, if we'd had nucleating snow in this episode, I wouldn't be making this call. But May 10th, 1990, we had in Waukesha, mainly a foot of heavy, wet snow, and in all directions from here, the farther you went, there was little or none. But that's not remarkable, maybe, but it stuck to all the leaves and the twigs and the branches, and who knows how many hundreds, thousands of branches and hundreds of trees were knocked over. Mm-hmm. It took until September to finish clearing up the mess. You could drive down some of the streets, and the wood was piled so high that you couldn't see the houses if there are one-story houses.
Wow.
You could see the second stories. What kind of event would have caused that?
I remember that.
This is the worst time to get that kind of sticky snowfall, when the trees are budding out. Because then they leaf out.
And the snow stuck to everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's the problem, because the branches aren't used to holding that kind of weight. So in the wintertime, you don't have the leaves and everything to collect additional snow, so they do fine. But when the leaves come out.
Why would that kind of condition occur in May? And the next year, incidentally, in July, we had a heck of a windstorm, and it
took down the rest of the trees.
Down a lot of the broken branches and maybe some trees that had been damaged in the snow a year before.
Yeah. No, such a snow event in May is unusual. I'd say it's probably once every 30 years or so. We had one in New England once about the same time of May, but a different year, and the same problem occurred. And, as Steve says, it really testifies to what a huge difference in the area of accumulating snow for a tree when you have leaves on it versus when you don't. I mean, it's just enormous difference. All that, you probably had bald spots of not much snow on the ground underneath the trees during that event. That snow would have all been...
Piles of branches underneath.
Well, yeah, but before they fell, you probably would have noticed it wasn't so much accumulating right underneath the canopy, and that's because it's being held by the tree, and it can't handle that. It's just not made for it. It's always made me wonder, though, that May of 2006, we had a really cold rain event in the second week of May. I remember this distinctly. Temperatures were in the low 40s, and it was raining. We had an inch of rain, so that was pretty close to the same kind of thing. 5 or 10 more degrees, we would have had a repeat. But how sensitive are the tree species at certain latitudes to that kind of thing? What happens if you get this devastating late snow, and then that same summer you get another blowdown event? Maybe you could just wipe out some huge fraction of your trees in an area, and it would take forever for them to come back, it would seem.
Yeah,
because they're generational. It takes a long time to get them back.
Well, now, why do you get a little cold spot, like around Waukesha, that you get rain there or snow there, and then maybe it rains somewhere else?
That's a good question. My guess is that you probably had temperatures that were nearly at freezing at the ground everywhere, probably really close, 32, 34, 35. And then depending on how intense the precipitation is falling, that's going to where it's falling most intense and sublimating, that is going from ice to vapor phase without an intervening liquid phase, that's taking a lot of heat out of the air to make that happen. So you can keep the temperature artificially colder where the precipitation's coming down most intensely. And I think that's where you get your heavy accumulations in late spring, late winter, very early spring snowstorms.
You talked about devastating the wood, the trees. Over the following number of years, some of the branches that were damaged in that snow, years later, the branches were still dying and falling off.
Yeah.
Trees were not the better for it.
No, that's a delicate balance. If you get a couple of knockout punches too close together, you're really in trouble with your part of your ecosystem. It's really interesting.
Thanks a lot, Dick, for calling. Appreciate your call. Hey, we have open lines again. You can join us at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us. The email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Guys, what are we looking forward to here in terms of winter? We talk about this every time, but let's now we've got a whole another month has gone by. What are you thinking?
La Nina is still active, and for that usually means we have a colder than normal wintertime, but precipitation can kind of go either way, in terms of above normal or below normal. But it's hopeful that we'll get good snow in northern Wisconsin with a La Nina year.
And a way I've been telling my friends about it is that when we have the opposite in the tropical Pacific, the El Nino, it almost it's a stronger chance that we'll be warm and wet.
Yeah.
So I've been telling them that is a low probability outcome.
Right.
And then anything else is, you know, luck of the draw. But I think being extra, being warmer than normal, being wetter than normal is probably not likely.
Not likely.
This winter. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Which is good for snowstorms.
Yeah. Great for
snowstorms. Good for skiing.
Colder or warmer? Colder.
More snow.
More
right.
snow.
Yeah. Not getting that liquid form.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's go to Kurt in Eau Claire then. Kurt, hi.
Hey, guys. Got a question for you regarding lightning storms, you know, thunderstorms.
Sure.
In my imagination, or does it seem like the rain comes down harder after there's like a lightning strike nearby? Is the energy being released from the clouds letting go of the rain or raindrops or something? Is there a connection there?
You know, there's been a lot of recent research with regard to the intensity of lightning strikes and the type of precipitation or severe weather that you get from a thunderstorm, like a tornado coming out or strong winds coming out. And that's only becoming available now because we can actually measure lightning strikes, not just those that go from cloud to ground, but within the clouds. And so I'm not sure what the answer is with regard to rain intensity. I know they've been seeing I think the way that it goes is that there's an increase in lightning flashes and then a rapid decrease, and then tornado signatures typically form.
It's a polarity issue, too, isn't it?
Yeah, right, and whether or not they're positive lightning or negative lightning types of things.
But maybe broadly a connection between intensity of rain and lightning just comes from the fact that you can't get lightning unless you have hail up in the cloud and it's and ice particles are rubbing against each other. Wait, you could have something less than hail, but you have to have a sizable population of ice pieces in the cloud. And that's likely going to testify to a pretty intense updraft in your thunderstorm cell. And that will mean you're processing a lot of water vapor and turning it into ice and then liquid. So there's that connection, maybe.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks for the info.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And let's turn to Armand in Lake Mills. Hi, Armand. Thank you for calling.
Hi. See, I don't know. I have an observation question type thing. I noticed over the last, let's say, 15, 20 years, when I drive from Lake Mills to Heartland, I used to take the interstate. And as I got to Highway 83, that always seemed to be like there was a front. The weather would start, the rain would start, or the snow would start. And same way coming back from Heartland down 83 to the interstate toward Lake Mills. It seems to be an area there where it was always a break or a change in the weather. Is that something to do with closeness to Lake Michigan? Or?
Now, when you're going down Highway 83, you're going north-south, right?
Well, as I approached Highway 83 on the interstate.
Oh, so you're going east-west. You're on the interstate.
East,
oh, okay, okay,
like
okay.
It seemed like there was a north-south line there that occurred around Highway 83.
Yeah, okay. In the summertime, there may well be, that might be the western extent of the sea breeze front that comes off the lake. And so in that case, the lake is playing a significant role in maybe organizing thunder showers or something like that at that longitude. In the wintertime, it may be the place where rain changes, where snow to the west changes to rain headed east. It's possible because of the same thing. The lake has a modifying effect the closer you get to it. Were those some of the symptoms that you saw?
Yeah, it was definitely noticeable over the last 15, 20 years, and there's no mistaking it.
Yeah, if it's those two things, those two weather elements, I would be willing to bet that they've been going on for hundreds of years in exactly that location, and probably haven't been enhanced very much in the last 15.
I must have missed it. Are you from out east somewhere?
Yeah, I'm from Boston, Massachusetts.
Oh, I'm from Massachusetts originally, and I noticed in your accent, and all that stuff.
Oh, yeah. where are you from originally?
I'm from New Bedford and Tiverton, Rhode Island.
Oh, New Bedford.
Massachusetts and Tiverton, Rhode Island area.
The famous whaling town. Yeah.
Yeah, right.
All right. Well,
okay.
Thanks, Armand. Appreciate the call. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call. I had an email from Dan, who's Presque Isle in Auburndale, Florida. So he's one of those guys that is probably now in Auburn Auburndale, Florida, would be my guess.
You're probably enjoying the warmer weather.
but he says an easy place to go for weather history is www.intellicast.com. I-N-T-E-L-L-I, intellicast.com. At the top left, you will see local in the drop-down is history. And so you just go to the top left, hit the drop-down, and type in where you want, and you get the history.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah, that's good.
That'd be nice.
Let's go to Tom in Burlington. Hi, Tom.
Yes. I live in Burlington here, and the tornado was on Walworth. Like, it went through Walworth. It jumped over Burlington, went down Highway 11, and then it struck in Union Grove. Mm-hmm. And now I've got two questions here. I have a friend. We had a tornado that hit about a month ago in Racine County, too. And I called my friend. She lives on Lake Michigan. And I told her to stay out of the basement because years ago there was a sage. I don't know if you're familiar with sage or not.
Yeah, siege, I think.
Siege or whatever it is. But anyway, it sucks the water up into the air, and then it drops it down like a tidal wave. And this guy down in the Gulf of Mexico, on the Gulf when they had that thing, they found him in his basement. He had lots of money. He was there with all his gold and everything. But I tell my friend not to go in the basement because she might get a sage, and she's right on the lake. Mm. So I wonder what your ideas are about this. And can we have a tornado when it's raining?
Yeah, so I'll let John do the tornado and the raining, but I call it a siege. So you probably can do both pronunciations, but if you hear me say siege, I'm talking about the same thing. And you can get sieges in Lake Michigan that are caused by thunderstorms. But generally what it is it's not upward motion sucking up the water. It's the winds pushing the water to one side of the lake. And then when the winds lighten up or move on to another place, like in a thunderstorm, all that water sloshes back. Now, the good news is that the question I think of is it more safe to be in a tornado and be in your basement and protected from a tornado, or running the risk of getting hit by a siege? And I think it's better to get in the tornado, get in the basement to be protected from a tornado. Because in the 50s, I think it was, there was a number of deaths associated with sieges. And so the city around Chicago did a lot to prevent that from happening in terms of both education and, you know, doing things with structures to prevent people from being swept away by sieges. So I would say still go to the to the basement.
Yeah, I agree with that 100%. The tornado is probably a more proximate danger.
Yeah,
And you can have tornadoes while it's raining out. In fact, they sometimes have rain-wrapped. They're so-called rain-wrapped tornadoes. And these are the kind that even the experienced tornado chaser out on the road looking for storms is most afraid of, because you can't see them coming as well as you can if the thing is just out there in relatively clear air. So you're a little bit more nervous about them. And then the final thing along the lines of the sieges is that it's not so common to get tornadic storms when you have straight-line wind damage associated with them. So you know what I mean? You don't have the combination of a tornado in the context of straight-line winds. And the straight-line winds are more likely to cause the siege. So they may be almost headed towards an exclusive type of situation anyway.
You don't see a lot of photos of the tornadoes and the rains because you can't get a good picture.
Yeah, you can't get a good picture.
So you get this idea that they only occur in clear skies.
Yeah, that's right.
There you go. Thank you, Tom, for calling. And Chris in Cooksville, your turn. Hi.
Hello. Thank you for the program. A wonderful group of guests you've got there.
Thank you.
You bet.
Thanks.
I wonder if you can help explain. I understand La Nina, El Nino, and the power and the strength they have over all of the Earth. Is that correct? Mm-hmm. I know that translates to the boy and the girl. I worry most about El Hombre. The man.
Yeah. That has so many levels of truth.
That's the severe El Nino?
Yeah.
I just wonder if there's, by chance, any connection between La Nina, El Nino, as to, is there a pattern that they tend to follow? When one shows, then we're then going to experience the next. Is there some commonness or some follow-up?
Yeah. Okay.
everywhere you look in the literature, it's described the whole ENSO, El Niño Southern Oscillation, which includes both phases of the warm and cold tropical Pacific Ocean. They always are referred to as non-periodic with a pattern of between 4 and 7 years. So, and even sometimes that's wrong. So yeah. It's very non-periodic.
Yeah, but they do occur periodically.
Yes, right.
That's the problem.
That's the weird thing about it. They do occur periodically. They don't occur exclusively periodically. You can have a weak El Nino followed by a stronger El Nino. So you don't always go from positive temperature anomalies to cold ones before you go back to positive ones. Even that periodicity isn't regular.
Yeah.
So it's really a very complicated interactive process between the ocean and atmosphere. People are beginning to understand it, but we're a long ways from really
understanding it. Yeah. All right. Well, we're a short ways from ending the show. So we are about out of time. So, oh my goodness, the last pretty much.
It's November. November's over. That's just not right.
November's over, and December, you're on the last Monday of December.
December. That's right.
Whenever that is.
27th, maybe?
27th,
somewhere in there. Christmas is a Saturday or something.
Yeah. All right. Well, we'll see you then. Thanks, guys.
All right.
Steve Ackerman, director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies at UW, and John Martin, chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at the UW-Madison. They'll be back the last Monday of December. Tomorrow, Kathleen Ernst talks about her novel, Old Murder, which is set at Old World, Wisconsin. Just finished reading it, enjoyed it very much. Stay with us here at the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.